this is essentially a warts and all account of what ASIO was up to in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, some of it's a little bit uncomfortable reading for insiders, because it's the benefit of unfettered access to the records, but also to the fact that we, the authors of the volumes, were ANU employees working from ANU and not being dictated to as to what we could or couldn't say, and couldn't be dictated to as to how we wrote the story. So we wrote it based on our what we read from the files and on the interviews we conducted, and our analysis and assessment of what the key issues were during this period. And it's all, as I say, it's looking at the world through the prism of secret security intelligence, the view of ASIO, the view of the world, the view of Australian society from ASIO's perspective in the 60s and 70s, and then reflecting on, you know, the pluses and minuses of that. You know, if I may say so, the most exciting aspects of the book is this reflection on society through this unheralded and otherwise previously unconsidered view of the world, which is the ASIO, the view of the world. And so trying to understand that, understanding how the ASIO people viewed the world, is actually quite a fresh perspective on Australian society during this period. It's controversial. Lots of people will not like aspects of it. Others will like some and not others. And I've had interesting different journalists from opposite ends of the spectrum react almost equally strongly to aspects of what I've written. So I think I might have been doing something right.
Yeah, so there's no chance of you being followed down the street by a black SUV while you're taking a walk?
Look, you know, I do look over my shoulder occasionally.
I bet. I would be too. It's really interesting. It's very interesting reading. So I wanted to talk a bit about the involvement of First Nations activists in the political arena. So 1972 was the start of the Aboriginal Ten Embassy in Canberra, which was a groundbreaking event. And as you say, a lot of the splinter groups that came in to support First Nations people helped build up, you know, a stronger community, and also empowering people to protest and bring forward the issues that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have faced from colonisation, and particularly around land rights. In your book, you mention a march in 1974 and where a First Nations man had a gun held to a police officer. Can you talk about that and Prime Minister Whitlam's decision for it to be more of a domestic issue with the police as opposed to ASIO penetrating Aboriginal rights groups?
Yeah, no, this is an interesting point Whitlam made. I think he appreciated that there were sensitivities to how to handle what was a bigger political issue than just an individual with a gun. I think he also probably at this stage is still a bit wary about ASIO. You know, while he was convinced of the importance of the function of ASIO, he wasn't enamoured with the people running ASIO or of the political orientation in his mind of those inside ASIO. And there was, I think, a stronger sympathy towards the perspective of the Commonwealth Police, subsequently the Federal Police. So from that point of view, it's understandable that he made that call. But in addition, this is a legal matter anyway. I mean, the police have executive powers. ASIO was not an organisation with executive powers. Therefore, it makes sense that Whitlam responded the way he did, I think.
Because there was a really strong Black Panther movement that came out of our First Nations groups, which connected our communities up with Black rights activists in the States and also in other countries across the world. Now, I know for a fact that there are a lot of Aboriginal activists who believe, because of their involvement with the Black Panther movement or having a strong political presence in the public sphere, that ASIO has been involved in monitoring their movements. Is there any more scope, do you think, for more writings on this? I mean, I believe that there could be a whole book written on it, and coming from a perspective from an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander person who's been involved in this movement, there's definitely room for a book. What do you think about that?
Yeah, no, it's a really good observation, and I suspect that there are many books that are yet to be written on aspects of Australian society that I touch on in this book and in Volume 1 and David Horner's Volume 1 and Volume 3, which I co-author with Rhys Crawley, Dr. Rhys Crawley. My sense is that there's quite a number of things like that. As you suggest, there probably is a whole book, if not multiple books, that could come out of exploring this question in more detail. Of course, for this project, what we're doing is providing an overview of all of the functions that ASIO is performing, all of the target sort of focus areas that ASIO was working on, of which Aboriginal protest was a fraction. You know, bearing in mind that ASIO's principal focus was on countering Soviet espionage, number one, and secondly, looking for proxies who would be supporting Soviet views to undermine the Australian government. Principally perceived at the time to be through the Communist Party and Socialist Party of Australia and the Trotskyites and things like that.
Yeah.
So that was their principal focus. And if you look at the allocation of resources, that's what ASIO's resources are principally allocated against. Aboriginal affairs looked at as and when they cross the radar scope, if you like, of ASIO's remit in that space. And it's in that context that it's referred to in the book. But as you say, I completely agree with you. I think there's multiple books that could be written here about the experience, the protest, the monitoring. I mean, there's so many aspects of Australia's Aboriginal history that is just remains completely uncharted.
You're listening to SBS Radio Living Black. I'm Kirsten Lindsay and I'm speaking with John Blaxland. John is the Senior Fellow at the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the Australian National University. John has researched and authored the second book in the series of ASIO, The Protest Years. We're talking about the second book in the series, The Official History of ASIO, from 1963 to 1975. We've been speaking about First Nations activists and a little bit about the history and the need for more publications on ASIO's monitoring of Black Panther and First Nations activists in Australia. We're going to be talking now about the dismissal of Gough Whitlam. Your writings are really interesting. I wanted to move into the dismissal of Mr. Whitlam because starting from the book, you know, 1963, Sir Robert Menzies was elected as Prime Minister and you finish off this book with the dismissal of Gough Whitlam and you know, just to briefly start up with Malcolm Fraser being elected in. Talking about the dismissal of Mr. Whitlam, there was information about Mr. Whitlam wanting the relationship between ASIO and the CIA and American Armed Forces to be more transparent regarding what was happening on the Pine Gap Agreement. And is it Ngarra?
The other side, it's just south of Pine Gap.
Can you expand on this for our listeners? Because it is important for our people because of the mobilisation of the military on our homelands you know, what this was about.
It's interesting, you know, because at the time, Pine Gap was a very, very secretive organisation. It was built in the late 1960s, an agreement between Australia and the United States to be built. And little was known about it, much like there was little known about this ASIS, you know, Australian Secret Intelligence Service, the Foreign Intelligence Service. It's spoken about in hushed tones if it was spoken about at all. And, of course, you know, you look back in hindsight, and now subsequently there have been numbers of books written about both Pine Gap and ASIS. And now people think, well, what was all the fuss about? Professor Desmond Ball, one of my colleagues at the ANU at the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre, has been prolific in writing about Pine Gap and explaining in extraordinary detail what happens there, you know, how it works and why, and who's responsible for what. So the mystique of it has long since disappeared. Back in 1975, it was still quite a mysterious place, a place that very few people had much of an understanding about at all. And, of course, subsequent prime ministers insisted on arranging full knowledge and concurrence on what was happening inside Pine Gap and what was arranged through Pine Gap. So there's been a significant transformation in the equation, if you like, in terms of what ASIO does and how it works and who knows about it and what levels of transparency there are with Australian officials, at least, compared to American officials. But nonetheless, there remains a certain mystique to the place, given its ongoing sensitivities and its ongoing significance for the United States and Australia and the alliance.
Your book says it can't be guaranteed or there's no real proof that Prime Minister Whitlam was dismissed because of his call for more transparency. I mean, during that time that he was in, there was issues around a leaked telex and also changing of Attorney General in the time and his relationship between ASIO and his staff. Do you think that he knew too much, and because he did put the call on for the Royal Commission on Intelligence and Security, is that what you you believe, or what's your thoughts on that?
No, look, I don't know that you can quite make a connection to that. The Royal Commission had been launched in mid-1974, and by late 1975, it was gathering momentum, but it was actually, people were starting to see what the Royal Commission was on about was actually something really quite healthy and constructive in terms of increasing transparency, accountability and responsiveness to government. And, of course, the consequences of the Royal Commission are dealt with in some detail in the upcoming volume, Volume 3, which comes out hopefully next year. I wouldn't draw a direct connection there between that. But it's interesting to think about what Gough Whitlam has said about the dismissal and about the conspiracy theorists. And he himself, you know, made the point that, look, you know, he had no question in his mind about Pine Gap, the treaty being renewed, because it was up for renewal, was due to be renewed. He has said that, you know, there wasn't any question about that. So the notion that it was about to get cancelled is actually, Gough Whitlam denied that. The other thing, you know, I remember I interviewed Malcolm Fraser, former Prime Minister, before he passed away, and asked him about the conspiracy theories. And, you know, here's the man who has only just before he passed away published a book called Dangerous Allies, which is a provocative call for Australia to distance itself from the United States and the alliance with the United States. Here was an opportunity for him to put the boot in, if you like, when I asked him this question about CIA and conspiracies. And he said, it's crap, total crap. That was his answer. Here we have Gough Whitlam playing it down entirely and Malcolm Fraser playing it down entirely. And so I'm thinking, okay. And I then searched through the files as best I could to ascertain what transpired and what the ASIO records showed. Now, what it does show is a fascinating exchange between this guy, Ted Shackley, the American intelligence officer in Washington, who challenges the ASIO liaison officer in Washington, and he says, get this message to Canberra. So the guy writes up this cable and sends it off to Canberra, and the Director General of ASIO duly passes it on to the Prime Minister. And the Prime Minister, Gough Whitlam, rightly reads it and directs that a response be written. And the response was written and sent. A lot is made of this, and it's no question, 2 years later, Gough Whitlam in Parliament read that very cable into Hansard in Parliament. So this is why we know that it's very common knowledge that this happened for those who, you know, have read about it. From my research, the view that the cable was symptomatic of a deeper conspiracy is simply not substantiated. What you see is what you get. You get an exasperated and perhaps angry intelligence community in the United States expressing through ASIO their concern. The message is passed on, it's received and responded to. People think that there's more to it, and they look to, you know, the stories that are out there. You know, the chief defense scientist spoke to the governor general and he was applying pressure, and it's not been substantiated. It's from single source, and it's from people whose claims have been challenged by multiple people. You know, what do you make of it? Well, you've got to, as a historian, you've got to weigh up the evidence and you've got to look at the balance of probabilities. And I have to say, there's a line that is attributed to Gore Vidal when questioned about this. And he said, you haven't begun to touch the tip of the ice cube. Which, you know,
oh dear.
I thought that was a pretty telling sort of observation. We do love a conspiracy, and I think we'd love to believe that there's more to it. And, you know, maybe there is. I haven't seen it, though. And certainly there's compelling arguments to be made that their conspiracies are indeed just that.